Right, so I think we'll get started with this next session. So I'd like to introduce you to our speaker for this session, Professor Errol Cox from the School of Occupational Therapy and Social Work at Curtin University. Errol has a background in clinical and educational psychology and has been working in the disability sector since 1970. His key roles include Director of Government Disability Departments in both Western Australia and Victoria, and Director of Disability Research Centres at Edith Cowan and Curtin Universities. Errol's presentation today considers the value of apprenticeships and traineeships as a vocational pathway for people with a disability. Errol will talk a bit about the challenges faced in conducting this research and will outline some pertinent issues about how disability is defined. Thanks, Errol.
Could I ask, for interest's sake, how many of you are Victorians? Okay, thanks. I'll be very careful what I say about my time in Melbourne, but I will make some reference to it because I think it's very relevant. I thought I'd spend a minute telling you a little bit about my background. Having said that I've been around in the sector since 1970, I've got a bit of explaining to do. I think my sort of acculturation in disability is fairly broad, both in terms of location, so where I've worked, focus, what I've worked on, and my degree of identification with disability issues. I don't have any direct connection with disability, like a family member or close friendships, at least when I was younger. However, coming into the sector in 1970 grabbed me in a way that, from a career point of view, and I haven't been able to escape that. So as I approach retirement, I just wonder whether I can finally step away or not. So from this point of view, as a researcher, I'm not really a disinterested person. I have a personal commitment to wanting to make a difference. And of course, I'm not unique in that by any means, but certainly I'm not what you might consider a typical disinterested, you know, in the correct way, scientific researcher. My approach has been very much to work as a practitioner researcher. When I was trained as a clinical psychologist, the model that we followed was of the scientist practitioner, which didn't really make a lot of sense to me until I started to work in the disability area. So I'm particularly interested in research that is about implementation, about translation of ideas and processes, and very much around outcomes and impact. So that's another sort of way in which I've been really influenced over the years. Just finally, as background, I started my first PhD in the 70s in the area of early intervention, where we were evaluating outcomes of what in the 70s were quite innovative early intervention programs. I then took a job in Victoria. So I came over here in 1980 and headed the newly created mental retardation division when the government finally moved disability out of mental health and within the then Health Commission formed a separate body. And those few years in Melbourne really influenced me a lot. One of the things I'm most happy in a way about was the closure of the first large institution in Australia. Some of you, the Victorians, might remember St Nicholas Hospital, and which was one of the 13 institutions that I had responsibility for as director, in which 3,500 people with many disabilities, not just, as we called it then, mental retardation, because Victorian institutions were the epitome of social exclusion. And if you were a problem of one sort or another, you would end up in one of these 13 institutions. The closure of St Nicholas was very impactful and led to future closures in Victoria and in other places as well. Okay, so that might explain some of the things I might say as I work through the presentation. So, left, great. I just need to acknowledge the importance of the support we've received from NCVER for this research, and also to acknowledge the other people that work with me, particularly Stian Thoresen, and also the three organisations and the individuals they were key national and local agencies that helped us very much with the research. Edge Employment Solutions, Group Training Australia, and NDS. What is the project about? Well, previous research, in fact, going back a long way, when I first did my courses in psychology and then later clinical psychology, at that stage we were getting clear evidence that if a person had a cognitive impairment in particular, intellectual disability, learning disability, and so on, then work-based vocational training was seen to be the most powerful and effective way of people with disability learning. Now, in those days, we had leaders, people like Mark Gold, who developed an approach called Try Another Way within this context of training or teaching people in context rather than out of context. And Mark was famous for actually teaching a man who had been with very severe impairments, had been institutionalized for most of his life, to assemble a bicycle brake. And this, in the early 1970s, really had an impact on many of us in the field when we began to see the possibilities of applying what we knew about behavioural psychology in particular to people with severe disabilities. So it seemed to us that the issue of apprenticeships and traineeships and the fact that they are essentially work-based education should be particularly appropriate for this particular group of people. The second point here is that we did some early work before we started this project. There were two studies that are actually in the reference list on these slides, that we carried out with Greg Lewis, who heads Edge Employment Solutions. Edge was probably the first competitive employment agency to be established in Australia in about 1984. And they've provided very significant leadership over, essentially over 30 years. Now, Greg had actually got some funding and had worked out that in a study that was finished in 2008, that if you promoted the cooperation or collaboration between group training organisations and disability employment services, you got better outcomes for people with disabilities in the employment area. I'm not sure that that research has ever really been fully exploited and taken up, as unfortunately is often the case. The second project that we actually worked with Greg and Edge on was looking at some of their own clients in Edge since they were established in 1984, just to see what sort of outcomes were achieved by their clients who had gone on to do VET and employment. And generally, this showed quite good outcomes, and it sort of inspired us to want to do some more work in this area, and we consequently applied for the NCVER grant and were successful. Overall, I think what we're trying to do is to add to an evidence base, which to some extent already exists, that examines economic and social outcomes achieved by apprenticeship and traineeship graduates. I want to provide a few more background factors. The issue of the definition of disability sort of comes into virtually any research that's done. And as many of you will know, we've moved quite significantly away from primarily a diagnostic approach to disability. So when I came into the sector, I worked as both an educational and then a clinical psychologist in a diagnostic and assessment centre, where the diagnostic process was the key way of identifying particular forms of disability. It remains very important, of course, in areas like autism, where we'll suddenly find that probably one in every two of us has autism, but the process of identifying it and diagnosing it is very important. But what the WHO did in two publications, 1980 and 2001, is to shift the focus away from diagnosis to the notion of function. And in doing this, concentrated on the notion of core activity limitations. Core activities referring to things like mobility and communication, and defined these in different terms, including mild, moderate, severe, and profound. And in fact, that approach has now been taken up very broadly in the sector generally, and much data gathering relies on the International Classification of Functioning, the ICF, that the WHO had developed. Using ICF sorts of definitions, the SDAC, the Survey of Disability, Ageing and Carers, which happens every few years, shows that the proportion of our Australian population who have a disability is very significant, 18.5%, which has dropped a little from some years ago when it was around 20%. And a very significant number of Australians have profound or severe core activity limitation, which is the most severe level of impairment using the ICF classification. We have a poor record in terms of labour force participation and unemployment rates. We certainly don't do well in the OECD stakes. And in fact, when the OECD started to alert and alarm OECD member governments, if they weren't already alerted and demand concerned about participation rates, they published a couple of reports earlier in the 2000s. That drew attention to this, and generally Australia wasn't doing too well. So you can see there that the participation rate is much lower if you have a disability, and also there's a clear relationship, with one possible exception, between the severity of core activity limitation and both participation in the labour force and also in unemployment rates. Similarly, there are issues with participation and completion for people with disabilities in VET. You'll see there that people with disability make up a very small proportion of apprenticeship and traineeship commencements. However, the proportion of VET students is reasonably good, and in fact it's increasing. Of course, I've got information there about course completions and passing course requirements as well. But I guess the conclusion we might make there is that the participation rates are problematic, particularly in apprenticeships and traineeships. I want to talk for a minute about the notion of exclusion of people with disability and the impact of enhanced participation. Both Dr. Shah and Professor Webb's presentations drew attention to the sort of the impact of place. However, if we go back about two decades, a very well-known medical researcher named Marmot and other colleagues identified what they called the social determinants of health, that showed quite clearly that various aspects of socioeconomic status, SES, was highly related to a range of different health problems. And of course, this is quite important because if you see the second dot point, you'll see that a very high proportion of Australians with disability live under the income poverty line, which of course can be defined in different ways, but that's a reasonable sort of conclusion to reach. In other words, a very high proportion of people with disabilities are essentially poor, and under the notion of SES being related to health outcomes through the determinants of health model, this becomes a very important issue. It's one of the reasons why we've, in the last couple of years, begun to focus much more around issues of disability health, because this is becoming an increasingly important area. There are the bottom two dot points are just some evidence from Deloitte's and also from NVIAC and ANTA that shows that if we're able to enhance the participation of people with disability in employment and VET, it's likely to have a big payoff. And of course, this becomes particularly important when we consider the National Disability Insurance Scheme, which has a number of KPIs, actually only three, one of which is about the sustainability of the scheme, which we're already seeing is problematic. And also because one of its KPIs is precisely about the issue of enhancing economic outcomes for people with disabilities. And of course, that means their KPI is essentially linking directly into the participation of people with disability in employment. Another minute on the notion of non-vocational pathways. You may know that in Australia we spend the AIHW data. Most recent data shows that we spend over $700 million, 10.5% of outlays on disability services, on what is called community access, which actually relates to essentially non-vocational activities. Now, that's not universal, because the day services that are funded through community access are not all non-vocational, however many are. So in Australia, we have a very significant number of people who are engaged in day services of one sort or another, which are not necessarily and probably largely not vocationally oriented, so they're not providing pathways into employment. There is a strong connection between these day programs and the engagement of people with disability in VET, but invariably these are CERT 1 and 2 courses that don't necessarily place the person on any sort of trajectory or pathway that may even have a career orientation, let alone end up in employment. Okay, just a word about the disability support pension, another big issue for the Australian government, where although there's been a slight decrease in the number of people on the DSP, we've still got over 820,000 Australians on the DSP, including a significantly increased number of people with mental illness who are on the DSP. Now, clearly this is a huge government outlay and is an issue that will have to be addressed, and we may well find there'll be further changes in eligibility criteria, which is one of the few policy levers that can be pulled around this issue of the DSP. Incidentally, it's also one of the few policy levers that the NDIS can pull in order to reduce its outlays. So my guess is that down the track we will see some attention drawn to issues around eligibility. Okay, well, after all of that, that's a long introduction. What was the study about? Well, it was a three-year longitudinal study investigating social and economic outcomes. We wanted to identify social outcomes around participation, relationships, networks, quality of life. We wanted to examine some specific economic outcomes. We wanted to identify what some of the barriers and facilitators to success in apprenticeships and traineeships. And we want to look at some of the differential outcomes between people with disability and those without. And we wanted to map some of the pathways that were being followed. Now, I must say that we have large databases that already contain some of this information at the sort of broader population level. But this, of course, was not a population study. It was a cohort study and has some qualitative elements in it that hopefully are adding to our knowledge. Okay, now how do I get back? That's it. We had a cohort of 403 people with disability, what we call the disability group, who came from a particular period of time in terms of the completion of their apprenticeships or traineeships. And we recruited them through disability employment services, GTOs, and registered training organisations, and also state training authorities. We also created a comparison group, relatively small, but the best we could manage in terms of the resources we had, that we matched essentially on apprenticeship and traineeship distribution, gender, and age. We found when we crunched some of the descriptive stats that there was quite a reasonable match on those variables, with two exceptions that I'll mention later. The way we gathered information was to use a survey, which we mailed out. So we made, for ethical reasons, we couldn't make direct contact with people. We had to do it through an agency or organisation. So the ones I mentioned earlier sent out essentially an invitation to people on their books to say, "Well, you're interested in participating?" And of course, then we dealt with the people who said, "Yes, we are interested." As I mentioned, the survey included the sort of things we wanted to look at, some socio-demographic information. We also reviewed some other surveys to try to embed some questions in our survey that reflected some from other surveys that have occurred. We had a low initial response. We estimate between 18 to 20% of the surveys distributed were returned. That is, people who replied and said they wanted to participate. And one of the reasons that we're not sure about the percentage is that the survey was sent to the last known address, and these people had finished their training about 3 years ago, so they probably moved on. We had a relatively high retention rate. This is always contestable, over 80%, and overall I think it was around 71 or so percent. We also carried out a small number of face-to-face interviews, 30 people in wave one, and then we followed that in the second wave and then in the third, and we're in the process of analysing that information at the moment. Okay, the characteristics of the cohorts. There's a similarity between the disability group and the comparison group cohorts. We had an older cohort than NCVER administrative data, and that's partly accounted for the fact that our participants had many of whom were 3 years or slightly more post-completion. We had an underrepresentation from Victoria, and this was largely because we didn't approach the Victorian State Training Authority, and those state training authorities in other states were quite helpful. The reason we didn't do that is that we both ran out of time and resources. So unfortunately, Victoria is not is underrepresented in our cohort. We had an overrepresentation of people with intellectual learning disabilities. Over 40% had intellectual learning disability as a primary or secondary disability. Concerns me that we, in a lot of our data, we combine ID and LD, but in fact they can be quite different, although there's an awful lot of overlap. It's a sort of a, the learning disability category is, I think, quite imprecise. A broad range of courses. Okay, what were some of the results? This report is available outside on the barriers and facilitators to completion. And just going through just some of this, because it is available. The comparison group didn't give us the same number of barriers and facilitators, obviously, because it's a much smaller group. For both groups, the issue of resources, both for barriers and facilitators, was the most prominent issue that they raised. By the way, we used InVivo as a way of analysing this data and essentially grouping it into individual statements and then themes, and then essentially counted those. So in terms of resources, the lack of time was a big issue. For example, if you had a disability, you might also have a family, and whether or not you do, of course. So the issue of studying, working, and family and other demands was an issue. Not enough time. Poor training wages was another resource issue. The cost of equipment and transport was mentioned as another particular problem. For people with disability, and interestingly, some in the comparison group who didn't acknowledge having a disability and probably didn't, but they may be relating to a health issue or an injury, but 6% of the comparison group also mentioned impact of disability, health or injury. Now, for people with disability, this was primarily about issues around literacy and numeracy. The difficulty of following printed or written lessons in particular, the lack of assistant technology, pain. Many of the people with disability put pain, they were experiencing pain as an issue, and sensory difficulties as well. In terms of employment factors, maybe one of the most interesting issues that we found was the extent of harassment and bullying that we heard, actually from both groups, but particularly from the disability group. And there is there have been papers or examination of this as an issue in this area. Okay, well, on the facilitators, possibly the most important issue that was raised was the importance for both groups, in fact, of informal support. So there was the issue of families, friends, co-workers, who were often called mates, at least the males tended to call them mates, and the importance of that sort of informal support that people received was really acknowledged as particularly important. In both the employment and the training and education areas, managers, supervisors, co-workers and so on who were helpful were acknowledged as really facilitating their completion. Okay, these are some of the economic outcomes that I'll move through fairly quickly. We did publish a paper in the Journal of Vocational Rehabilitation on this. It's the same journal that we published the two papers that we did the work with Greg Lewis on in some time ago. I think that those two were published in 2011, this one earlier this year. Okay, so in terms of labour force participation in our disability group and our control group, because we're not entirely disinterested, we were really interested to see whether there were significant differences. And in fact, if there weren't significant differences between the control and the disability group, then in some ways we would think that would be a good outcome, because what we would like to be able to show, if it's happening, is that people with disability who complete apprenticeships and traineeships essentially achieve similar outcomes to people who don't have disabilities, which is, from our point of view, a very important outcome. So in terms of the proportion that were either employed or looking for paid work, that is, they were participating in the labour force, remained relatively high over the 3 years. Now, there was an effect from the attrition rate that I haven't got time to go into now, but that would inflate somewhat these figures over time, since we did have people withdrawing who, in fact, were not participating in the labour force. So these figures are probably somewhat inflated. We found no statistically significant difference in labour force participation, and that also applied when we looked at apprentices and trainees as well. We thought we're interested in the sustainability of employment, and interestingly, a relatively high proportion of graduates in both groups were still with their host employer, that is, the primary employer during their training, which we thought, some people might say, well, once you qualify, you're probably better off going into a range of different occupations. That there's an argument for that. There's another argument that says, well, you're obviously valued by this particular employer, and you have got a degree of sustainability, so you can weigh up which of those you might think is more important. So both the comparison group and the disability group had similar outcomes there. What was the main income source across the three waves? Well, wages and salary was the most frequently cited source of income. For the disability group, the disability support pension was the second most frequently cited main source of income. In terms of hours of work and wages, the weekly hours of work in the first wave was lower with disability group than the comparison group. Similarly, hourly wages as well. But what we found as a sort of a general conclusion in looking at these data is that although there was a difference in the first wave, as we moved into the second and the third wave, the difference was reduced. So by the time we got to the third wave, there was people in the disability group, the average wage, for example, at $910 was higher than in the comparison group. So we think this is an important outcome, although we've got to look more carefully at the people who moved out of the program or didn't return to it in wave two or wave three. But we think this deserves some further consideration if it in fact shows that over time the difference begins to be reduced. Okay, no significant difference in hours of work or wages. Again, you get the, in terms of hours of work and wages, you get the difference decreasing over the 3 years. I'm sorry, this is for apprentices and trainees. The other one was for... Never mind. Okay, disability support pension recipients. So we've looked a bit more closely at this group. 25% of the disability group cohort were on the DSP. And being on the DSP was associated with lower participation in the labour force, similar working hours and lower hourly and weekly wages. So in wave three, DSP recipients work fewer hours, but similar hourly and weekly wages. Between waves one and two, which is all we've had a chance to look at, less than 3% of the people on the DSP moved off it. Okay, yeah, that may or may not be a large proportion, but I would say that it's probably small. Okay. In the few remaining minutes, a few outcomes from in terms of social outcomes. So the sort of questions we asked here are typically the sort of questions that are asked around participation in many sort of standard instruments. There was 64% of the disability group and 60% of the comparison group were members of at least one group or club. So there, in fact, if you're in the disability group, there's a somewhat higher proportion. We didn't ask the question about whether the group or club was related to your disability, but we well know that if people are connected, for example, with disability agencies of one sort or another, there are often social activities developed around that. But nevertheless, there is a relatively high proportion who were members of a group or club, were attending social events at work, because we're really interested in the notion that work is a context in which social inclusion and social participation occurs, where friendships are developed and so on. And sure enough, people in the disability group were doing as well on that or better than people in the comparison group, including meeting people after work or on weekends. We looked at issues around relationships at work, and generally this showed that the comparisons here are not very different, but the people in the disability group largely reported that they have good relationships with their co-workers. They felt as though they were part of the team at work, which from out, we really see this as quite positive outcomes. There wasn't a sense of alienation or separation coming through in that way. More broadly, again, a reasonably substantial level of happiness about the work situation. Also in terms of social life, that was a little bit lower. And satisfaction with life overall, and including the notion of saying, well, how do you think life's going to be in a year? So these are quite significant proportions in the strongly agree area. And when we can move to it, I think we should be making some comparisons with some of the other studies that have used very similar questions for broader populations. Okay, so finally, if I can just make this reference to the National Disability Insurance Scheme. As I said, they've got three KPIs. One or two of them are about the sustainability of the scheme and getting economic outcomes, and it's a no-brainer in a sense to consider that the issue of participation in the labour force and the use of VET and apprenticeships and traineeships as, I think, quite acceptable and very positive pathways to employment would seem to be a really key area of policy development by NDIS. And if they haven't already cottoned onto this, I think that this undoubtedly will happen, and we're likely to see a lot more attention being paid to those pathways. So in conclusion, differences in graduate economic outcomes between research participants with and without disability move towards equalisation over time. Social inclusion outcomes were positive and reflected the important role of employment. And our conclusion, which I think is supported by other data and other studies, indicates that apprenticeships and traineeships are positive vocational pathways. Okay? Thanks.
I think lunch has just started, but we've probably got time for one question if there's anyone who's got anything in particular. Francesca?
The only thing we've really had a chance to do is begin to look at the disability support pension. One of the issues is that with 40% of the group being in the intellectual and learning disability group, we've got a big overrepresentation. And in terms of analysis, we probably haven't got large enough numbers in the other groups. We followed a fairly typical pattern in the sense that the biggest group was IDLD, and I think then physical disability was the second biggest group. So we ended up with a cohort that had a very similar distribution once you take out the big IDLD group. But I'm not sure that we'll be able to do much statistical analysis on that. Any other questions? It probably would be, but it's probably not an area that we're going to follow up. I think if I might say that what reinforced to us was the need to look much more closely at transition issues, and that's probably the area that we want to focus on. We published a report in 2008 for the Disability Working Party. You know, that organisation, the ministerial group that funds research. And we looked at the interface between employment and ATE, alternatives to employment, because even then that was acknowledged as a big, significant issue, because the states are putting so much money into day service programs, and there was very little evidence of people, of that being a pathway to employment. And some of the qualitative analysis we did showed us that the decisions that are made when the kids are still at school really was impacted by whether there was any work-related activity going on in the school, and also on the attitudes and approaches of families. And what we found unequivocally was that families were very conservative about the options they chose. So if it was a choice between an adult day centre or an ATE program or whatever you might like to call it, that's state funded and more predictable and closer to home and so on, many families would choose that as an option rather than the risks associated with employment. Now, there were one or two policy levers that have been pulled to try and impact on that. Things, for example, that make it policy that makes it easier for people to return to the DSP if employment doesn't succeed. But nevertheless, there is a big issue about the decisions that are made in those final maybe 18 months, 2 years of schooling that just put people with disability onto a particular trajectory. And we think this is something that we need to look at, we would like to look at much more closely. And in fact, the methodology should include some qualitative methodology. That is, we need to sit down and actually talk to some parents and service providers. We need to talk to DESs and GTOs who can work into school-based programs, because we think they are potentially policy directions that will pay off. Finally on that, the work that Greg Lewis did some years ago now showed that if you got the GTOs and the DESs to work together, and in fact he actually had money, he could pay them to actually do that, and they did it, that when that occurred at the school level, it really had good outcomes. So it wasn't large-scale research, it was almost qualitative, but it was showing that now, if you did this sort of stuff, you get a good return. So I'm sorry, I probably should have spent more time on your actual question, but it's more what we would like to do next rather than follow that up.
Thank you.
you.
Now we can move out. So,